Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, speculative fiction writers Darcy Littlebadger, Michi Trotta, and Suzanne Walker discuss their work Crafting Other Worlds with Writing and the science fiction genre at large. The following conversation originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. My name is Noelle Velasco, and I'm one of the education program coordinators at the museum. Thank you all for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. One of the most magical things writing can do is transport us to another world. Our next program looks at how science fiction and speculative writing can build a place so real that you'll want to book a plane ticket when you're done with the book. Darcy Littlebadger is Lipan Apache writer with a PhD in oceanography. Her critically acclaimed debut novel, Alatsowe, was featured in Time as one of the best 100 fantasy books of all time. Suzanne Walker is a Chicago-based writer and editor. She's co-creator of the critically acclaimed, award-nominated graphic novel, Mooncakes. Her short fiction has been published in Clark's World and Uncanny Magazine. Moderator Michi Trotta is five-time Hugo Award-winning Filipino-American writer, editor, and narrative expert. She is the executive editor at the environmental justice and advocacy nonprofit Green America. Welcome to you all.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for being here. I know we have a short 40 minutes, and with these two wonderful authors, that is going to go by real fast. So I would just like for the authors to really quickly, if you can introduce your, pronounce your names again with your pronouns, so we are all aware here.
My name is Suzanne Walker. I use she, her, or they, them pronouns.
My name's Darcy Little Badger. I use she, her pronouns.
And again, my name is Michi Trotta, and I use she, her pronouns. Okay, so world building. I think for a lot of folks, this is both one of the most exciting and most intimidating aspects of being a writer. It's sort of the tyranny of the blank page on a literal universal scale. So I'd like to start off by kind of asking you, what are some of the parts of world building that you are most eager to do when you are starting from scratch?
I think for me, the thing that I like the most is picking out the little details first and building around them. I have a novel that is on submission right now that I had a very small detail to start with, which is that instead of horses, there are velociraptors, because...
Of course there are.
Of course there are. Why not? But I took that... That was originally just like a one-off detail that was used for basically for fun. But I built an entire culture around it. And, the raptors have special significance in the religion of the world. They wind up being very much tied to, like, the hierarchical government system. And I love just taking like a small, tiny little idea that I had and really building it into the fabric of the world because you get to explore, things come up that you never would have expected.
Yeah, I have to say that I also love those little like details, and it's usually some sort of story seed of inspiration that ends up blossoming into a full book. My first and my third book, Alatsowe and Shenelende, both take place in the same world, and it's a world very much like ours. So a lot of the world building aspects has already been done for me. They live in Texas, and one is the 2020s, one's the 1970s. A lot of the real world events are based off of things that actually happened. But these main characters are from a family line that can raise the ghosts of animals. So I remember starting Shenelende, I was thinking, like, what kind of creative things can I do with just this little difference? How would having this ability change the world around you? And so, of course, I was like, the main character must have a bloodhound, and it must be a missing person mystery. And people are going missing because of fairy rings. But then I think, well, how would the existence of fairy rings affect things in our world? What would it do for transportation? What if we had like the ghosts of mosquitoes and the ghosts of lightning bugs and things like that existing alongside of our world? So it is really cool to just riff off of these and seeing just a weirder version of the reality we live in.
I mean, all of the details are always a really fun thing to get into, but in terms of craft, how do you keep yourselves from getting too into the weeds and going down all of those rabbit holes?
That implies that I do. But no, for me, it is very easy for me to go down a research rabbit hole and really like get too far up into my own world. Especially there was a period when I was in revisions and I just got so sucked into the details of the world that the craft itself was suffering. Like it wasn't, there were things that didn't make sense to the reader because I was so wrapped up in the intricacies of the world. And at that point, I think you just really need to pull back and look at it from a sort of macro level and realize that like, even in like today's world, like there are plenty of things that I don't understand how they work. Like, I don't understand engineering or, I don't know, that I don't understand a lot of things. But and you can write a world where not everything is known. You can write a world where there are some things that are just a little in the shadows and obscure, and you either will create those details when you come to it, or your readers can use their imagination. And so I think that's really important.
Yeah, it can be difficult for me too, because I come from a science background. I got my PhD in oceanography, and so I've published some papers on the genetics of phytoplankton. And like even when you're doing a paper that's not like, oh, groundbreaking discovery and all that, even if it's just like a very basic describing the genetics, you really have to account for every detail because you're thinking from a perspective of, I'm sending this off to a committee of my peers and they're gonna pick it apart and we gotta make sure that the science is solid. So like coming from that background into coming, you know, writing fantasy fiction, it can be difficult sometimes with the details because I can get a little bit just following that trail, what if, well, what then? So like, let's say we have these fairy rings and they suck up all the biological material within the ring. So, well, how would that happen? You know, so then I have to tell myself, this is a book that is also for just enjoyment. And sometimes with fantasy, you let the readers put their own imaginations into the world. So I'm still struggling with that, but it helps to have an editor. So my editor will tell me when I really don't need to get into these wax poetic about the fake biology of this imaginary species. And when I need to take a step back and just let my readers do some of that work for me. Because I have to say, readers have like really cool imaginations. And sometimes I've gotten questions where they ask me something where they contextualize my world in a way I didn't even think of. And then I'm like, wait, yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you go for that. That's your canon. But on the other hand, sometimes having that background does help a little bit with plot holes, so hopefully I don't have too many. I mean, don't tell me if I do, though. It'll bother me.
Yeah. Having a history background definitely helps with research because I just love going to the museum or going to the library and just, like, searching for primary sources and going down that rabbit hole, and that's something that appealed to me before I started writing fantasy fiction, and is definitely... it helps.
Yeah, this is the excuse you're telling yourself for why you started studying broadsword.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, firsthand experience helps, too.
Yeah, actually, this reminds me of something that John Scalzi had said when I asked him a similar question about writing Kaiju Preservation Society at the last Writers' Festival. Because we all know, and I think we can include ourselves in this grouping, that as fans, we can get very much into looking at the work of a writer and wanting to pick it apart just to understand how everything works. And something that John said when it came to writing Kaiju, he's like, same thing. You can get into the biology. You can really get into the nitpicky of the world building. But the way that he got around that with, like, well, how are you going to explain the biology of the kaiju, the biome of this entire world that you created? He literally had the characters at one point asking these questions because mm-hmm. they were the new people mm-hmm. in the scene, and then the characters who were the scientists been there for a while says that they drop a bunch of binders on the table, and they're like, we've studied all of it, you can read this on your own time, which seemed like a pretty clever way to get around it, and sort of acknowledges that that's what we tend to do as readers. Mm-hmm. Suzanne, you were talking about what drawing from that firsthand experience. And I think one of the things that I was very curious to hear from both of you is, you know, we often write based on our own lived experiences, our own expertise. You know, there's that advice that says, write what you know. And a lot of times it tends to be taken as a prescriptive, only write what you know and what you've directly experienced. But you create worlds that don't exist as far as we are all concerned. So how do you take what you know and how do you navigate creating worlds that feel lived in, where you are drawing on your own experiences, but you're also accounting for your biases and the things that maybe you haven't experienced but wish that you did? How do you pull all that together into creating possibilities that exist beyond what we know to be realistic or attainable, whether it's in terms of internal personal growth or an external world?
So for me, I think it's a lot of sort of a push and pull of, I do want to put some of my lived experiences into my stories. In my graphic novel, Mooncakes, one of the main characters, Nova, is hard of hearing, and she wears hearing aids, and that is very much, it is not a book about hearing loss, but that is woven into the fabric of her story and her character. And that is something that people don't necessarily think about how that would affect magic, because she's a witch. And so I used what I knew about wearing hearing aids and like having a hearing loss to sort of create a magic system that would work for her around that. But at the same time, there's a lot to Mooncakes that is not my lived experience, and it is not necessarily what I know. Like, it takes place in New England. The two main characters are Chinese American. The grandmother is Jewish. There's a lot that is just not my identity. And I think for that, it comes, you very much want to, just be aware, as you said, of your own biases and be aware of how you are writing these characters. I think in many cases also having friends who you can talk to or having a collaborator really can really help. I worked with my co-creator, Wendy Hsu, was the artist, but we really came up with these characters together. And Wendy is Chinese American, and working with her, we were able to sort of build off of each other's experiences and a setting that she was familiar with. Like, she grew up in New England. And that, I think, is really helpful. And that's really why I love collaborating with people and building a world together, because you have someone else outside of your own head. You have people who you can build things off of together.
Yeah, and it's kind of, so in a lot of my books, I do draw a lot from my personal experience, and some of that is it's just easier. So I write about Texas because it's just, I've lived there, I know what it feels like and what the plants are, and my family has lived there for many generations. Oh, it's wild. I literally just flew to Chicago from Fresedo, Texas. We returned the remains of my ancient relative who was found in what's now Presidio country. And is linked through the maternal line, mitochondrial DNA, but that this relative died 750 years ago. So I was like, all right, so clearly my family has been in Texas for a long time. Who knows? It was kind of stunning when we learned that, but that's a whole other story. But on the other hand, I think that as writers, we have curiosity about people and, you know, people who are different than us, settings that we are unfamiliar with. And so I do try to think about the lives and the behavior and the thought processes and the actions of other people. I don't want to say in the way of like a scientist would, but I do wonder, like, why do people do what they do? What is life like? I'm writing a fourth book where the character is like super into practical magic, and she's inspired by Harry Houdini. So I've been reading just tons of biographies about Houdini and how he's an immigrant, you know, the son of people who came over here, and he worked his way up, and, you know, I'm indigenous. I mean, on my dad's side of the family, we're Irish American, but I don't know much about that. So it's an experience that is very different from my own family's, and yet there's so much in there that is, like, you know, difficult and inspiring. And I was like, I'm so happy that I'm doing this research, and what must it be like to be a great magician like that? So it is that combination of both, you know, curiosity, trying to, you know, be empathetic about people who are different from you, but also drawing upon your lived experience to add those insights that you, just growing up, have been kind of collecting and creating these worlds, these fantasy worlds, these science fiction worlds that really reflect the human experience. You know, either genre fiction, but it's very much fiction grounded in, you know, human life. But yeah, so I guess that's my long answer to that.
No, I think that actually segues great into what I was sort of thinking about. Suzanne, you had mentioned before sort of the push-pull of realizing that while you are creating fictional worlds, you are creating stories of fictional worlds that are going to be consumed in the world that we live in. And, you know, one of the things that I think all of us in some way, shape, or form have had conversations before about context, and that the stories we create do not exist in a vacuum. They are not consumed in a vacuum. So when you are thinking about how your worlds are possibly going to impact the world that we live in, how does that figure into your process as writers and just, you know, as people who read?
I write fantasy for a lot of the same reason that I study history. And it's because it is most powerful when it is a mirror to the world that we live in right now. And I think that for Mooncakes, part of what makes Mooncakes resonate with readers so much is, like, it's in this fantastical world. Like, there are werewolves and there are demons, but it's also very much in our world where we have these characters who really care for each other. They have these characters who are dealing with hardship and very much real world discrimination. And I think that metaphors for oppression and discrimination in fantasy can be done very poorly sometimes, mm-hmm. and I think that they can be done in a way that just feels tokenizing almost. But I think that when it is done with care and when it is done less to be a metaphor and more, this is what these people in the world are dealing with, because they might live in a world where there are sea monsters or velociraptors or whatever, but they're still humans. They're still people who will have biases, who will love each other, who will wield power over each other. And I think that's really where you have to focus on creating a world that is going to exist and also be read by humans.
Yeah, so I write for young readers, you know, teenagers. I would say middle grade through high school are my primary audience for my first three books. And something that people might not guess based on my social media, which right now is basically Instagram, but I've moved off to Blue Sky and I've now started Threads. I was like, okay, I guess I should do this, is that I am, I don't want to say pessimistic about things, but it's very easy for me just to take, like, the gloomy, melancholy take on difficult matters. So it's very easy for me to just, like, kind of give up, like, oh, it's going to be terrible. But when I write my books, I don't want that to be what my readers are reading, especially when I base my books off of, you know, Lipan Apache people. We exist, and I... when I was in Presidio a couple days ago, I went to the middle school there and spoke with a small class of students. And I had with me a member of my tribe who translated both Spanish, but who is also like learning Lipan language. And something that whenever I go to a class and I see young readers, I think to myself, what can I do as a writer to give them hope? Because I wonder if I'd read stories where people like me were able to, like, obviously not without difficulty. A lot of the characters in my books go through difficult situations and tragedies, but ultimately they overcome, they persevere, and my endings do tend to be hopeful. Because I wonder, like, if I grew up with those hopeful endings, would I still be so, like, melancholy about things? Maybe not. But I want kids to know that there are people out there who are fighting for their future, and that they should not give up. Because, for example, in Alatsue, there's this reference of this burial ground. When I wrote Alatsue, the Lipan had no tribal land. And I kind of talk about this in some of my other works, but I came from a history of, like, my family lost our home, my grandmother lost her home, so, like, you know, before that we lost all of our homeland. So I came from a history of just real life made me think that it was inevitable for us to always be displaced, never have security, we're not going to have a house to live in, you know, we're going to be living in a motel because we had medical bills and we could no longer afford our land. So when I wrote Alatsue, I thought we'd never have tribal land. So I reference offhand this traditional burial ground, Cementerio del Barrio de los Lipanes, which was formed in, you know, the 1700s during the mission period and has lots of our bodies. And it was a garbage dump because nobody was taking care of us. And I was like, we're going to be powerless. And then just a year later, because people in my tribe were fighting for this land, including people whose ancestors are buried in it, Texas gave this land to us. The first time in history Texas has ever given land to the Lipan, and I don't know about other, like, indigenous groups of Texas, that we're all treated pretty poorly. This is something that I never thought would happen. And in my pessimistic brain, I was like, we're never going to get any tribal land. And now suddenly we do. And now my ancestor is being reburied in it. And we're getting more land for the living. And it's because people didn't give up. So I was like, in my stories, I just have to give people a reason to hope. Like, that's all. Even if I don't feel that way, I want my readers to feel that way.
That was great. Thank you, Darcy.
It's been a wild week.
Yeah, clearly. The two of you are being great about easing in very naturally to all of these questions that I had written down that I would love for us to talk about. You know, when we have all been part, throughout our careers of the representation conversation, and I don't want us to have to repeat a lot of those things that we've already talked about. But representation, it matters, but it is the floor, not the ceiling. No matter how many people try to convince us that it's the finish line and now we don't have to worry about oppression ever, ever again. Then the thing is that representation is power. And, you know, I think you've illustrated that beautifully with why you write stories with hope. So we are in a different position than, you know, many other, straight white writers, where not only are we thinking about the responsibilities of creating representation, we are often seen or perceived as the representation ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I would love it if you could maybe talk a little bit about how you have navigated that and how that impacts your creativity and what you feel like is possible for you to write in the market or what you write for yourself.
I think that it's a hard question that is not to immediately go down the pessimistic route, but it's like you can't win either way, because if you don't write something that is speaking to your aspect of representation, then you're not doing enough for that particular group. And if you are, people will worry about whether you've done it right. Like the fantasy novel that I have on submission right now is a secondary world that is based on 11th century Middle East. And that was in many ways a way for me to connect with my Lebanese identity, because I grew up fairly isolated from that aspect of my heritage. And the whole time I have spent worrying that if I'm doing it right, like if I am depicting this in a way that is appropriate or is done well. And then there are people who are not of that identity who have it published who never worry about that. And it's just fine. And I think that that's not a bad thing, but I think that there's an extra burden on like having to be the representative of that group. Like there are very few Arab American genre fiction writers in the community. Like,
or at least who are visible in the community.
The community. Like that I it's counting on one hand. And again, that I hope that changes. I very much hope that changes. But it's a very like feeling of responsibility. And as of right now, I have not published anything that represents that aspect of my identity. And I, you know, worry about people thinking that I'm being culturally appropriative because I have a very anglicized first and last name through my dad. But there's also something really freeing in being able to write about these aspects of your identity. You know, writing about somebody with a hearing loss, which is a part of my identity that I spend a lot of time trying to pretend doesn't exist because it is an invisible disability. People don't notice it right off the bat. And I just grew up being conditioned to repress that. And having it in a graphic novel where her hearing aids are so visible right there is huge for me. And it's when Matt Fraction and David Aja wrote Hawkeye, and they had a storyline where he became deaf and used American Sign Language. And it was the first time I'd ever seen that in a comic before. And it was amazing, and I loved it. But there were little things that I sort of wish that little things that you wouldn't know unless you are somebody who's hard of hearing. And I wanted to put that on the page. And I was able to, and that was really powerful and something I really valued.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times in the past few years I've been like, oh, I wish I could have just done a pseudonym and leaned into my dad's side of the family and pretended to be a white writer, because there's a lot of stuff. All right, I think I shared this in a writer's board that Suzanne's part of, but this happened even last month. So WorldCon is a big science fiction fantasy convention. I'm getting into it.
Yeah, Darcy, do we have to?
Okay. No. So in 2019, I went to my first WorldCon. Latsaway had been bought but not yet published, and I was on a panel with a few other people. Anyway, cut to last month, I put out a book announcement for my third book, and I was like, Shani Lende's coming out. I'm really happy. And then somebody like posted her this, like, do you know this woman? And a panelist who had been with me said, oh, there's this Native American writer, and I met her in Dublin. She's Lipan Apache, and she used to have long hair and love her culture, and now she has short hair and horrid colors and ugly nails, and she's like, her Lipan heritage all but forgotten. I was like, what is going on? All right, first of all, those nails were made by a Native artist, and they were based on the book that I'd just written. They're really beautiful, by the way. I have a picture on my Instagram. And like, funny enough, I actually cut my hair for a traditional reason related to grieving. But it shouldn't have to matter. Like, these stereotypes that are brought in about what a real Native is, and I'm trying to just be a person. Like, I've always been a little bit alternative. Like, I was I wanted to be a goth in high school, but you know, I sat at the table with the goths because they were kind and they accepted me. But, you know, I've always been a little bit in terms of fashion, a little bit dextra, but just to have this associated with me not loving my culture, which is the opposite, it was very shocking. And also to have this associated with an announcement about a book, Shannon Lende, that delves into the tragic history of my people in Texas in the 1970s was something else. But then I didn't name this person because I don't want to get into it, honestly. But then I heard from a young Native writer. Well, she hasn't yet been published, but she's working on it, and she does beautiful art. She called me a matriarch, and she called me, like, inspiring. I was like, oh, what? I always thought of myself more as, like, maybe auntie level, but to be called, yeah, I was like, I'm not sure I'm at matriarch level yet, but to be called that, and just to have me out there, and me with my strangeness, and my personality, and as an example that, you know, Native people can be all sorts of things because we're people and people are all sorts of things. It's sometimes not easy, but it's something that I feel like I want to do. And maybe someday a Native writer can go to a science fiction and fantasy convention without being judged for not having long hair. But, well, hopefully soon.
Oh no, we're going to have a conversation about the how that relates to the, what do you mean you're streaking your hair purple as an Asian?
Oh,
isn't
boy.
That like playing into, yeah, we're going to have a talk about that. We have just around 5 minutes, and I really wanted to be able to get to this question before we closed out, because we write because we love it, but also we got to eat. So I would really like to hear your thoughts about how do you deal with the influence of commercial pressures when you are building worlds that you know are going to be sold for consumption and the development of capital, which doesn't always go to the authors, let's be fair. So I'd love for you to be able to, like, have some thoughts on that.
I don't. and I'm not saying that to be flippant. Like, that is not something that ever comes into my mind when I write. And that might be part of the reason that my career has gone the way that it has. And, like, I have been extremely fortunate and extremely lucky, and I'm very happy with the things that I have published. But I've also not published a lot in the last 5 years. I have a novel that's on submission. I don't know if it's going to sell.
You had a story in Star Wars. I think you need to.
I said I haven't published a lot. I didn't say I haven't published anything. I've one in the last 5 years. I have published one short story, and I loved that story. And it was in a Star Wars anthology, so it was very commercial. But my original fantasy, I don't know how commercial it is. I don't know if it will sell or if it will appeal to the masses, and I don't know what my career is going to look like in the next 5 to 10 years. And it's been a very hard process of realizing it has to continue to not matter, because if I start writing for the masses, like, then I've lost the reason that I'm writing.
Yeah, kind of same here. And I say I'm very fortunate in that my second book, A Snake Falls to Earth, which it's a very interesting book. It's told through two perspectives. It has like three different endings. It won a Newbery Honor. So that has given me that little boost in income, at least for last year, that was able to, you know, now I'm a full-time writer, but I don't think that's going to last, honestly. And I have turned down jobs, or I have told people in positions of, like, you know, agents, editors, who want me to write a certain type of story. For example, Tommy Orange's works are very popular. They're there, and he just published Wandering Stars, and they're brilliant works. But there is pressure for Native writers to imitate Tommy Orange in terms of our themes and in terms of our style. And I was talking with some folks a month ago. What was I doing? I was doing another conference, and they were told by a person in publishing who is very much a type of gatekeeper, that native stories have to be literary for now, and eventually sci-fi fantasy will take off. So I don't think that's something I care much about. I became a writer because I was a sci-fi fantasy fan, because I have my own voice, and I think that's why most people become writers. Taking that commercial hit is something that I've done and something that I'm comfortable with. And if I have to work another job again to get by, I don't really. What other option is there? You can't really sacrifice your voice and your art and stuff like that for the commercial and churning out these books that they think will sell. And trends are so fickle. And I think if I did that, I would always feel a little bit bad. So I'd rather not, but it can be very difficult. And people who do make sacrifices, change their plans, their voice, whatever, in order to get by, I understand that. And it's something that we all have to make our own choice based on our own situation and what we're comfortable with. And who knows, maybe somebody will be told, maybe you can write a book that's similar to Tommy Orange's book. And they'll find their own voice, their own way to do something similar, and they'll find that they love it and they enjoy writing it, but, you know, that's just not me.
The best fantasy world that I can think of right now is one where writers can make a living full-time and it is not impossible.
Well, add to that the world where writers' identities are not being commodified themselves mm-hmm. as a product to sell.
Yeah.
And I think that is a great way to end it. We are at time. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming listening to us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.